This show is part of the Head Stuff Podcast Network.
Christy Dignam sadly died a couple of days ago, and I just wanted to put out this podcast again from 6 years ago when Christy had invited me into his house for a chat. And he was very open, very honest, talked about his, not just the musical career, but his addiction to heroin as well. And he was just a genuinely brilliant, honest, very witty, very funny, and talented man, and a nice, lovely man. And it's very sad to see him go. I knew, we all knew it was coming, but it's still a shock. So I hope you enjoy this. This is my chat with Christy Dignam. All right, Christy. I was just actually up there talking to, I don't know if you know Eric Lawler. Eric Lawler is a comedian. He lives up in Poppentry anyway.
I do know him, yeah.
Yeah.
He's good.
Yeah, he's good. And yeah. Willie White.
And Willie White's great, yeah.
He's from Ballymun.
That's right, yeah. It's funny, I met Willie, the first time I met Willie, we were doing a gig in Mount Joy, and he was a prisoner at the time. And I remember looking at him, and he was in fucking bits, you know, and thinking, geez, I think he had 6 months left of the sentence. I said, he's not even going to make the next 6 months. The next time I was with Willie, we were doing a gig in Mountjoy, and he was one of the artists. So it was fucking great, a great success story, you know.
Right, yeah, yeah.
Willie's a lovely bloke.
The first time you saw him, he was in prison.
Yeah, he was a prisoner at the time, you know, yeah. So then when we went back up, he was performing for the prisoners the next time I seen him, you know, which was great, because I thought he was, when I seen him in prison, I thought, man, this fella's fucked, you know.
Yeah.
Because he was really bad at the time. I think he was strung out and stuff at the time, you know.
Yeah.
I don't think he'd mind me saying that, you know.
I've talked to him on the podcast, and he's kind of told me the whole story, yeah.
So that was it, yeah. So Willie's a cool bloke, you know.
Yeah, he's a funny fella. Did you grow up near Willie? Did you grow up
Finglas West there, yeah. But I would have known Willie when because I was strung out as well. So, I mean, we used to score in Ballymun, so I kind of...
Oh, you would have known him when you were...
active, yeah.
Yeah, that's what you call it, active.
Well, that's what I call it, yeah.
Yeah, okay, right.
An active participant.
Right, okay. So tell me, when you were growing up, were you a performer? Well, like from an early age, from a child, did you feel like
I didn't think I was, and I look at kids now, and they're in the Billy Barry School of fucking music, and it sickens me. It fucking sickens me. And I was nearly one of those kids when I think about it, right? Because when I was in school, I was in the school choir. I loved singing. I always loved singing. So I was singing from the times, and when I remember being a young kid, like six, seven, eight, and hearing songs and thinking, when I'm a singer, I'm going to record that song.
Yeah.
Honest to God, at that age, it's really weird. But then when I was about 11, this woman started a troupe in Finglas, the Black and White Minstrels. Very PC. But I went around getting all the photographs and burning them. But so I did that for a couple of years, and we used to go around doing talent contests and all that, you know. So then nothing for a while, and then when I was in secondary school, Joe Jewell, the guitarist of Aznan, had formed a band, and they split up then. So I knocked down to him one Friday and said, listen, I want to get a band together. And he said, I'll call back next Friday. And I'd done that for about 5 weeks. And then I went down one day, and we got a gig in the Ballymun Towers, actually. It was a first gig.
Right.
So we had a week or something to rehearse for it. And I remember it was for the Irish Youth something, but it was really an IRA fundraiser gig.
Oh, yeah.
And they asked us to play the Bleed National Anthem at the end of it. I had no fucking clue. But I still don't know the National Anthem. But so.
And was that like around time of punk, or
that would have been around the evening before punk.
Yeah,
this would have been the beginning of 75, kind of, you know. So,
so you wouldn't have been punk then. No. What kind of music were you doing? Was it covers? Was it?
We used to do Tin Lizzy covers and shit like that, you know. And we didn't write songs. We didn't know. I had no clue about. Never even thought of writing a song. Do you know what I mean? We used to do Bowie stuff and Tin Lizzy or whatever.
Yeah.
Lou Reed, all that sort of stuff.
Tell me, how did Bowie affect you then growing up? Because for me, I actually cried. I don't cry when famous people die, but
no,
Bowie died.
I'm still in fucking shock over the Bowie thing, you know. To me, you know, if my influences throughout my life was in a cake graph, he'd be fucking three quarters of that cake, you know.
Yeah.
You know, he's a huge, huge influence. And, you know, you look at artists now, right? Alice Cooper, right? Mm. Alice Cooper came out with an idea, like we were talking about a few minutes ago with you about the Father Ted thing, right?
Oh, yeah.
Alice Cooper came out with an image back in the fucking 70s. If you see Alice Cooper today, he's the same haircut, same black eye, same. And I meet loads of singers like that, or artists like that, that he got a little niche 20, 30, 40 years ago, and they still look at Bowie. You look at Bowie from 1975 up, and he grew old gracefully. Everything, even his death was graceful. Even the way his funeral was graceful, had class. Everything about the man was just pure fucking class. And everything he did was at the highest echelons of fucking whatever he was trying, you know. And he did a lot of shit, you know. But the way I look at it is he kept trying. Exactly. You know? The way I look at it, I would rather somebody like for example, Radiohead are kind of another example where they come out with Creep and that kind of brilliant fucking albums and then done OK Computer, which is a total twist around, you know. And even if you didn't like OK Computer and thought it was shit, at least he tried something fucking different. And Bowie was the same, you know. You know, when you're trying to do something new all the time, of course you're going to miss the target every now and again. Anyway, you could ask yourself, what is the target? Do you know what I'm saying? Maybe that was Bowie's target. It mightn't be your target. Do you know, it mightn't be what you wanted. You're in a weird position when you're, and I only know this from my small fucking association with music compared to Bowie, but your fans, right, for your next album, do you want the song to be like the last song but different? Do you know what I mean? So you're trying to make something new and fresh but still retain the same themes or something that's in the, you know, so people still recognise you as fucking who you are. Do you know what I mean? Like, we couldn't come out with a metal album now, do you know what I mean, or something like that. Well, we could, but
I do think every man has a sound anyway, and no matter what style you try, you probably have the
sound.
But
look at Bowie.
Yeah,
would you say Bowie, look at his sounds. Do you know what I mean? That's what I'm talking about.
But
that's how good he is.
You still know it's Bowie, though.
That's because of his vocal. That's because of his voice. Okay. You know, you can't change the voice he has. He's still the same voice. And that's another thing that makes him brilliant. When I studied singing for fucking 13 years or something, and the one thing I learned about singing was that when we start off as singers, we like the way Bowie sings this, say, door, window and room. We like the way Phil Lynott sings sky, plane and car, and we get all these idioms.
Yeah.
And you end up putting all these idioms together and you start singing and you go, well, I was a roller, and you're singing this fucking American mid-Atlantic accent. Do you know what I mean? Or you hear blokes from Finglas singing, well, I was going down the street, just, you know, and you think, what the fuck? It's about stripping all that away and getting back to what you are and just getting your essence, because that's the only thing that's original. It's the only thing the world hasn't heard. Yeah. And Bowie seemed to know that inherently. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So all the time, that's why I'm saying he had that thing, because he always sounded like Bowie, but that was his vocal. If you listen to what was going on behind him, that was totally different.
It was, yeah.
That's what I'm talking about.
But it did take him a while to discover himself. Yeah. His first album,
The Laughing Gnome.
Yeah, he has a bit of shit at the beginning.
Of course there was. There's
plenty of it, actually.
Yeah, and there's a bit of shit later on, you know. You know, that's what I'm saying. When you're trying something new and fresh, you're kind of going to miss the target every now and again, you know. But when he hit
once Hunky Dory came out, that was just incredible.
Unbelievable. Yeah. Unfucking believable.
Yeah.
You know, and even some of the stuff, even the Let's Dance stuff that would, you know, by the purest Bowie fans would be kind of look down on. I still think there's some great songs. China Girl's a fucking Iggy Pop song, but there's some great stuff on that album. Let's Dance is a great song. But it's just people didn't like it because you meant that commercial and all. But up to then, Bowie had only sold, up to a few years ago, Bowie only sold 9 million albums. Now you look at fucking Sade, sold 9 million of her first album. Bowie didn't sell a lot of albums, and people used to be inspired by Bowie. And like a lot would say, people that like us that would be artists, you know, are in bands, would have bought Bowie albums. But the general public didn't. And people thought Bowie was this huge, huge star. Bowie only started making money when the internet came out. And he got on top of that. He was the first to get into that and use that as, you know, for selling his music and stuff. So that's where he made all his money, you know. And that's an, you know, so Bowie needed a Let's Dance to fucking pay the rent, yeah, you know.
So. And actually, can you remember the first time you saw Bowie? Did you see him on Top of the Pops or something like that?
Was, yeah, Life on Mars. I'll never fucking forget it. Life on Mars was the first time I saw Bowie singing. You know, it was on Top of the Pops as well.
Yeah.
And that was it. From that moment, it was the first record I ever bought. Yeah. And from that moment on, I was sold, you know.
And
I remember looking at the NME years later, you know. And we say in the late 70s, he was playing in Newcastle and was trying to get the money up to go over to Newcastle to see him. Mm. And then when he brought out the Let's Dance album, he was playing in Milton Keynes, went over, the Serious Moonlight Tour it was called, went over there to see him, got a train or a boat across to Holyhead, bus down to London, another bus back up to Milton Keynes, just to see the gig. It was unbelievable, you know.
Yeah.
And then, you know, on the way back, we had a Bowie session in the television room on the boat and all, you know. It was bleeding great.
Wow. I think it's 30 years ago you got to open for Bowie in Slane.
Yeah, when we were signed to EMI, and Bowie was with EMI at the time, and we heard he was coming over here to Slane. So we said to the manager, I said, listen, we don't care if you never get us another gig. We don't care if you don't do anything else for us, get us fucking to support the Bowie and Slane. So we got it, and you know, that was a big moment, you know, because, you know, to play with Bowie was fucking huge. I remember at one point we had this song called Sands of Time, and there was a kind of build up in it, kind of 1, 2, 3, 4, and the song kind of kicked off, you know. I was in the middle of the song, and there was Peter Frampton and Carla Salamar, and Bowie were standing at the side of the stage, and they kind of looked at each other, and, you know, and it was fucking,
you got like the thumbs up, the,
yeah, and that was like unfucking believable, you know, unbelievable. Just to think that you even heard one of our songs, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, that's incredible, actually. Yeah. I just think it's amazing though, when you're growing up, like I grew up in a farm, I believe you grew up in Finglas, but you're both
identified
Bowie.
With Bowie, yeah. That's
incredible.
You see, that's the thing. Sorry.
But it's just an escape from that humdrum world.
Yeah.
You see, there's something out there that you can attain or that you
But the fact that we could both identify with them, coming, as you say, from totally different places, you know, that's the sign of a true great artist. Because a great artist can, like, you look at the songs like My Way, you know, or Go On Now, Go, Walk Out the Door, Just Turn Around Now. Every woman on earth would like to think that the bloke that shafted her back when she was a teenager was walking up to the door and she said, no, fuck off, go on. Every board would love to think that's her, you know. You listen to My Way, everybody would love to be at the end of their life thinking, you know, I might have done this wrong, that wrong, but I did it my way. So when you can get into that, when you can hit that nerve, that hits mass, and Bowie had that. So it just proves it in what you just said. We came from totally different backgrounds, yet we could both identify with him, you know. Because, as you say, it's an escape from whatever our normal life was. It was an escape out of that, you know what I mean? And that's what Bowie brought to the pet table.
But I think you might have thought, I mean, I would have thought growing up that being in a band was an unattainable thing until punk happened. Would you agree there?
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
I remember, it's funny, I remember somebody telling me about Slade. Do you remember the band Slade?
Yeah.
And I heard you were from Wolverhampton, from a working class place like Finglas. And that fucking blew me away. That was an epiphany for me. Because I thought you were born a rock star. Do you know what I mean? I thought God appeared to Mick Jagger and says, you have the divine right to be a rock star, and appeared to Bowie and all these people. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So then when the punk thing happened, then you know, when we were growing up, they were the bands we were looking at, and all that prog rock was huge. Genesis and bands like that, Pink Floyd and stuff, and they were all way unattainable, but so unattainable.
Yeah.
It was so far beyond the realm of your world, and then punk happened. And that was just, holy fuck, here it is. Now you could, that, I loved it, you know, the whole, everything about it. you know, do you know the dandelion mark? I don't know if you're around for that period.
Yeah.
But that was just the fucking energy. It's funny, I had a big row with John Carney, who wrote that Sing Street. You know the Sing Street?
Yeah, Sing Street, the film.
We were out in, I have the cancer thing, and I was going to the hospital there a few weeks ago. I'm doing chemo at the moment. And I was on my way in, and I seen a bus. This was a while, but before the film came out. And I seen new Irish movie, fucking the new commitments, Irish production, Irish this, Irish that, Irish the other, you know. Fucking great, great, called Sing Street. It's a musical featuring Spandau Ballet, fucking Duran Duran, fucking all these English bands, you know. So I thought, oh, that's a bit fucking weird, you know. So I met John Carney in RTA, I was doing the Late Late Show, and he was there. And he said something, he asked me what I thought or something, and I said, well, I'll tell you, I says, I thought it was strange that you were writing about a time in Ireland when music was probably the best it's ever been in vibrancy, do you know what I mean? And a new idea, it's the likes of your band, of Guernica, just fucking Blue in Heavens, all, whether you liked them or not, the Cactus World News, and Two and New was a house.
DC9,
Some Kind of Wonderful, Some Kind of Wonderful.
Yeah, like that
was
fire,
brilliant, Light a Big Fire. So he wrote a movie in Ireland about a time, and but didn't have one Irish fucking song in it, you know. So he said, oh, Glenn Hansard wrote the theme song or something, right?
Yeah.
You know, but this thing in Ireland that we still have, that we have to be endorsed by fucking England before we're taken seriously, it's ridiculous. It's ridiculous.
It is ridiculous. I get annoyed by that all the time.
Yeah.
And a lot of, even in the comedy world.
Yeah, especially in the comedy world.
If you got a sniff of Latin on BBC, people think you're amazing.
That's it. Or you go on to the Apollo, the live
the English
Apollo.
Like you, you must be good.
Yeah. You have to go, you know these QI or so, you know these programmes, if you appear on one of them, you know the panel programmes.
Not
Jason Bourne, you know the other Bourne?
Ed Byrne.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's all he does, as far as I'm concerned, because I've never seen him fucking standing up and doing a comedy show. I've never seen him in a sitcom. I've never seen him in anything else. The only thing I ever seen him was panel shows.
Panel shows, yeah.
But maybe that's his bag. I don't know.
So, like, the first band, is that the band Electron?
So we found Electron, which is doing all these covers and stuff like that. So then punk kind of happened for us, say, in 76.
Hold that closer to you.
Punk started, happened in, say, 76, 77, when it happened for us, do you know what I mean,
yeah,
over here.
Yeah.
By the time it really got here, you know, in its full force, and then all the things changed. So then Aslan Art.
Oh, well, you were in Electron.
Electron were gone then. That was, we had to knock that on the head because...
Oh, Electron was before the punky thing.
So then we found a band called Mila 18. 18.
Now, I lived on Shanless Road for about a year and a half.
Right.
And I used to see Mila 18 graffitied everywhere. And I didn't know what it meant or what it was.
Yeah.
It was unbelievable.
Yeah. Well, my brother used to do that. He used to just go around. He had a fucking a stencil.
Yeah.
Just a piece of cardboard with a thing cut out to me. And he used to go around and spray it up
everywhere. Where does the name come from?
It's a book by Leon Uris. It's Mila 18 was a house in Warsaw. It was the address of a house in Warsaw that the Jews used to hide in during the Second World War.
Okay.
And it was like a
like in the Anne Frank type, a safe house, or
there was kind of a, do you know the French resistance? So it was like a Polish resistance kind of thing going on. And Leon Uris wrote a book about it called Mila 18. So for some reason that impressed me when I was a kid. So you know, we are always looking for a name, and before we did it, XV111, because we thought that would be cool.
Roman,
you know?
Because
you're so intellectual, you know. You know the way you are.
Well, you know the way a lot of, well, even the band I was in, Guernica, was a bit pretentious, to be honest.
But you are pretentious when you're a kid. You know,
I know.
It's fucking great.
Because we were talking about George Byrne, and that's what he hated about our name as well, that we were just normal lads trying to be pretentious. I remember he used to hate the name Les Enfants as well. He'd go, what the fuck are you French? Like, what do you just call it? The Children.
I think he's right in that sense about Les Enfants, you know.
Yeah.
Because, you know, that's like what we're talking about, the accents thing. Why do we assume, like, we hear Bob Marley, and it sounds exotic to us, you know, that Jamaican accent.
Mm.
We hear Damon Albarn talking in his Cockney accent. We think that's fucking exotic.
Mm.
We hear Liam Gallagher in his Manchester accent. Did they not realise that when they hear our Dublin accents, they think that's exotic.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? But, you know, we always kind of try to copy or emulate all these
Yeah, but
things.
I think I was talking to someone about that. I think that's still a hangover of colonialism.
Absolutely. Absolutely, it is. And it's the same thing what we talked about this endorsement that we still need from... I remember doing a thing a few years ago, right? I did this, the Irish football song. You know, the World Cup, in the World Cup, right?
Yeah.
So I sang the whole song. It was actually in a house song. And they changed the lyrics of it into...
Great art or whatever.
You know, yeah. It wasn't a great art. It was another one. Anyway, it doesn't matter. I forget it now. Anyway, I did the whole song, right? So Nicky Bourne out of Westlife came in and done a few doo-wops in the chorus, right? So Ray Darcy was at the run of the whole thing. He organised it all and it was for his show and all this carry on. And it became the official Irish song of that year, right? Mm. Or the football song. So we're doing a video for it, and we're in the he said, right, we have to be in the airport hotel on Sunday at fucking 2 o'clock to do the video for it. The Irish football team are going to be there, and we're going to do this video. Mm. I arrived at 2 o'clock, right? So could you wait there for a while? So I sat in the lobby of the hotel till 4:30, right? I'm fucking sitting there, and I'm starting to crack up, right?
Mm.
So 4:30, the whole thing started to kick off. Nicky Bourne walked in then. He ran over. Oh, we have a room for you, Nicky. Do you hear the fucking room? Brought up to a room with bleeding sandwiches and coffee and all.
Mm.
I sang the fucking song. And I'm sitting there since 2 o'clock like a fucking doorman. Do you know what I mean? And this was simply because he was in Westlife. Do you know what I mean?
Mm.
And that infuriates me. It's ridiculous. It's outrageous that you would treat... And I remember at the time saying to Ray Darcy, I says, fucking outrageous the way you would treat another Irish artist. I said, I have done more to earn respect in this country as a musician than that cunt will ever do. But he's earned more money, so you could treat him like that. That's fucking... I said, that's disgusting what you've just done. Huge row. It's a throwback, as you said, from the famine and the colonialism and all that. It's a throwback to all that.
Yeah.
We still feel
inferior,
and you have to not dab our caps to the British, you know.
Yeah. I would have thought that would be gone by the time this new generation came along, but it doesn't seem to have.
No, that's in our DNA. It's going to take a long time for that to get out of us, you know. Like, it's only 150 years ago, the famine, you know, when you think about it.
Yeah. I was going to say, so Mila 18, they were kind of punky.
So we kind of got into the punky, you know, the whole vibe, the ethos of the whole punk thing. I just loved all that, you know. And as we used to go to see all the, you know, punk bands were coming out in the north, the Outcasts and Rudy and all that. Do you remember all those bands just coming out in the north? And we used to go, they'd be playing the McGonagalls and all that. Oh man, just brilliant. Fucking brilliant. I loved it. Loved it. And it opened, it made
we're
it possible,
about,
didn't it?
What other venues? The Magnet, right?
The Magna, that's what we played in the Magna. I played out with the Blades, supporting the Blades and stuff. And,
yeah.
But, the bag of Toners. Toners. Do you remember Toners beside the bag?
Yeah.
It was the kind of downgrade from the bag, you know. So there was McGonagall's, all those places. The top hat out in Dunleary. You went to see the Clash out there.
Oh, were you there?
The Virgin Prunes as well. You used to go to see them in the Project Art Centre. There was all these. There was a great gig called the 24-hour gig Into Darkness. Do you remember that?
No.
U2 played it. A lot of the bands come over from England, come down to the north, the Virgin Prunes. It was just 24 hours. Pill played it, actually.
Wow.
But it was great, yeah.
Wow. So was Mila 18 not... What made you change? What changed from Mila 18 to Aslan? It's all the same lineup, isn't it?
Right. Yeah. So we're going along with Mila 18, and we're right. You know, it's funny. Les Enfants had a bit of a hand in it. We are playing in the Ivy Rooms. Do you remember the Ivy Rooms in Parnell Street?
I played there myself.
Yeah. So we were upstairs and they were downstairs, and it was a Saturday night, I think, and our gig was jammed, right? And there was about 10 people at Les Enfants' gig. So the following Monday, I opened the paper and Les Enfants signed multi-million-pound deal with Chrysalis Records. I couldn't fucking believe it, you know. I was saying, these cunts can't even draw a crowd in Dublin, you know. I was working in Telecom Ireland at the time. I was a telephone technician. And Joe was the same, the guitarist. And so I went to the band the next day and I said, right, I'm leaving my job. we're going full time with this music. I says, because the only way is because we have these jobs, it's robbing us of the hunger to succeed, because we know we've got these jobs to fall back on, you know. So I says, I'm leaving my job. So Joe says, yes, so am I. There was a piano player we had worked in Guinness's, and he said, oh, me bollocks, I'm not leaving my job, you know. So he stayed in the job. So it cut down to just me and Joe, I think, was the only two left from Aslan. So we had a guy that used to call Mick McKenna, who used to be in Depeche Mode. He was living in Ballymun. He was going to Ballymun Comp, and we heard about this guy. So he played bass guitar. And when Depeche Mode went all synthy, he fucked them out.
Yeah.
So we grabbed him.
Yeah.
So he came in. So we are going around at the time in Fingus. There's all these, the Alien Comfort and all, there's all these bands. So I was trying to get the best musicians out of every band, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So Alan Downey was the drummer from Alien Comfort, but he was only about fucking 12 or something at the time, I can't remember, but he couldn't go into pubs or anything. We used to have to lie about his age and all to play in the likes of the Baggy. But we asked him to join, and he says, let me think about it. I felt like slapping the head off me. I'm a little cunt. You're getting a chance to be an air band. Because you know, we always think your band's the best band in the world.
Yeah.
So I thought he was a cheeky little bastard. But I kind of admired his spunk as well. Do you know what I mean? That he done, because he was much younger than us. So that was that. So we were going along. And then we got Tony McGuinness in the band. And Tony played acoustic guitar, right? And Mick was playing bass, the Depeche Mode dude. Now, Mick was a good songwriter, but Jordan, we only had to sit down for a break in a rehearsal. Tony would pick up the bass, and holy fuck, you know, he just killed it. He was a great bass player, he still is. Tony's a fantastic bass player.
Yeah.
To have a listen to some of his bass of our early stuff, and he played fretless bass a lot at the beginning. Yeah. Beautiful bass player. He was influenced by Pino Palladino. Do you remember Pino Palladino?
No.
He used to play with Paul Young and all those people.
Oh, right,
he was a great bass player.
Guy,
yeah, 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 that's him.
That was big. Mick Karn played the fretless around the same time in Japan, right?
Yeah, all that, yeah.
Yeah,
Tony
yeah.
would have been influenced by a lot of that. That was, yeah. that was after the punk thing, wasn't it? The new romantic
yeah,
thing, you know?
Romantic.
So, so Tony, we said to Mick one day, listen, you'll have to go on acoustic. And we're getting, so Mick wasn't having that. So Mick left the band. We were down to a four piece. So it was me, Joe, Tony and Alan. We were the four members of Meal 18. So then we were going around doing a few gigs. So we were doing a thing called Lark in the Park. Dave Fanning used to run it. And Les
Enfants.
Yes,
yeah.
In the park, St. Anne's Park.
Yeah.
So Les Enfants were the headlining band. We were the opening band. We were the kind of the lowest of the support bands. So we got Billy. Billy was, he asked, could he do backing vocals? And so we used to get him to do backing vocals. So the boy, he used to come, we used to rehearse in Alan's gaff in his garage. And Billy worked in Bowlands, he was a baker. So he used to come, we used to rehearse 5 days, 6 days a week. From 9 till 5 every day. So Billy used to come up about 3 o'clock after work with a load of cakes. Yeah. So we used to let him rehearse us because he used to bring the cakes up. Right. So we got a Fanning session. Do you remember? I was just a quick one on the gig, just the St. Anne's gig. We went out, and the gig was on a Sunday. And on a Friday, I had to go over to an industrial estate in fucking Ballyferrin. And I bought this dry ice, right? Blocks of dry ice.
Yeah.
So we had to wrap them in fucking bales of newspaper and put them in these big cardboard boxes to stop it melting, right?
Yeah.
Because we were going to use these on the gig.
Yeah.
In the park. And
dry ice was actually something you physically bought, like.
Yeah, we bought the blocks of it, yeah.
Yeah.
So. Great idea. So we went out on stage and fucking put the dry ice. One went fucking gone.
Did
you couldn't have lighting a cigarette on stage. You couldn't even fucking see it.
Oh, really?
The work we had to put in to get keeping this dry ice alive, do you know what I mean? It's fucking ridiculous. But anyway,
yeah.
So that was a funny thing. So anyway, so Billy used to come up. So we got a Fanning session, you know, and we got £190 for it. That Fanning used to get paid to do a Fanning session. We'd done 3 songs. So we went up to the Boot Inn, it's up past the airport, and we got fucking pissed, you know. It was the first time ever to earn money in a band. So we got absolutely pissed. So the next day we went up to rehearsal at 9 o'clock, you know, and Billy arrives in at 9 o'clock. I said, what the fuck are you down here, you know, wet and no cakes, what's the story? He said, oh, he's asked me last night to join the band. I went, oh fuck. So that's how Billy got into the band.
He's been in ever since.
Yeah, so then he picked up a bit of keyboard, a bit of harmonica, and he became an integral part of Aslan, but, you know, that's how he got into the band. So that's how...
Can you put your finger on why, like, even in Mila 18, you were getting big crowds?
I don't fucking know. To this day, I still don't know how we do it. I swear to God. Like, we did 3 Vicar Streets just there at Christmas, and it sold out, the 3 gigs were sold out. And like I get young kids, like 18, 16-year-olds to fucking 70. There was no one can celebrate our 80th birthday at Vicar Street last Christmas. You know, right through. I don't know how that.
Well, I mean, I can really see how you do it now. But when you're starting now, you haven't got any publicity, right?
No, I don't know. It was started off as families. Like I come from, I have 8 brothers and sisters, and they all had mates. Do you know what I mean? And so that's where it really started, isn't it? You know.
Well, like there was, they became like, oh, I don't know, what would you call, like a symbol for this Northside area. Like,
yeah, but
like,
that worked against us.
Did it?
Absolutely. We're still saying to this day, we're still saying as these scumbags who rob cars and batter L ones, but the odd time write a song from the Northside. Like I remember we were playing a gig one time in Vicar Street, and the Point actually, and I was in the car, and there's Yoke on FM 104, one of the DJs, and he said, oh, everybody get their Ben Shermans and their Ronnie's out, Aslan are in town tonight, you know. And that's the impression people,
right, yeah.
You know. Now, we do things, me and Joe do this acoustic thing where we go around all these little theatres and it's just me and Joe, and we tell stories about where the songs came from, and we play some of the more obscure Aslan stuff as opposed to the Crazy World stuff and all. And I found we are getting a completely different audience, an older audience who are sitting down and listening to the songs, because it wasn't in a pub or, you know, it wasn't any of that mad, you know, because people expect that. They think, you know, they're going to get their bags robbed or their gigs and stuff like that, you know.
You think?
To this day, it's still the same, you know. Like, a classic example, the Jerry fucking Ryan, the Jerry Ryan fella, right?
Yeah.
I remember we were sitting again at one of these awards things, you know, and we were at the table, and I was sitting here, Jerry Ryan was there, and Dave Fanning was there, right, and there's all our wives and all were sitting at this table, right, and Jerry's around talking to Dave Fanning, oh, fucking, how's the bleeding going, fucking Christy?
Really?
They were dumbing down for you, you know, and I thought, you fucking prick, you know. That was the attitude, always has been, it still exists to a certain extent, not as bad as it was. But that, so that little working class, Finglasy thing, Northside-y thing, that started off maybe being a little bit endearing. And it was almost, for the likes of the RTE Dublin Force, it was almost like their little forage into the bleeding, the slums, the ghettos. Do you know what I mean?
And getting a little slumming bit. It.
Yeah, exactly, you know. So, but it tended to work against us.
Right.
As well, to a large extent, you know.
Maybe the doctor said the same thing, as only they had the culture
thing, and they're fucking huge. We were off in London last week, and they were over. They've been doing a tour of fucking Scotland and Britain, and all. Like, they're jamming people in these places.
Yeah, and outside of Ireland, no one.
We played with them in Dubai.
Yeah,
we played a gig with them in Dubai, and they're fucking, it's a great gig, you know.
They
can do it anyway. Because if you're Irish and you're away, like I remember seeing them in Dubai, and they're doing this song, and he's saying, and I'm standing there in my Galway jersey, and I'm 50 yards out from the post, and I'm looking at the post in Crow Park, and I'm running at the wall, and you could see all the crowd bleeding tears running down
really?
That
line.
And I thought, oh man, you have a sussed, haven't you?
Yeah. It's great when something that is local can be identified in the universally, you know.
Absolutely.
Everyone has their football team. Everyone has their small town.
Yeah. It's not parochial. It's that same thing that we talked about with Bowie, you know. Mm. It's hitting the fucking nerve that everybody can feel, you know what I mean? That everybody can identify with. And the Saw Doctors kind of have that, you know.
Yeah.
Whether you love them or hate them, you know. You have that.
Anyway, well, so you were struggling then, I think, to get a record deal. Would that be correct?
Like, well, that was the thing then.
Ongoing saga.
Well, every band, wasn't it, at that time? You wanted to get the big deal, especially after Les Enfants thing, you know? Because I remember seeing them then on the Tube a couple of months later. You know, oh, man, that was the... You know, do you remember the Tube?
Les Enfants on the Tube, really? Well,
so you know, so so we had to get a record deal. So there was a band called Toy with Rhythm, right? Yeah. And they were playing a gig in the Revenue Commissioners in North Great George Street, and we were supporting them. And a few record companies came to see them, and the record companies were coming over to us after it. You know what I mean? And fucking talking to us and all that. And the manager of Toy with Rhythm then, Danny Kenny, started to manage us, right? So he knew how to kind of deal with these people. We didn't. So we were going and we were doing loads of showcases, because once one record company, they were looking for the next U2 at the time, do you know what I mean? So once one record company showed any interest, they all start coming. But then as soon as one rejected you, they were all gone. You know, that was the way the system. So we weren't ready at the time. Do you know what I mean? We were only kind of starting to find our feet as musicians. So we are seeing too early, I think, you know. Mm. So the record companies were coming over. I remember doing a showcase in the television club. I don't know if you remember that.
Television club.
Was a huge club, right? So there was just us on stage, full production, with fucking three chairs in the hall. The three record company blokes sitting in it, you know, and we're playing as if it's a full venue. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? It was hard shit,
that's
you know.
Nuts. I've heard about that kind of thing.
Yeah, so we did a lot of shit like that. But I remember that, you know, your man, it was Chrysalis Records again, and he said, "Listen, we're going to sign the band. Fucking love it. We just have to work out the economics. It's fucking great, you know." So they went home Monday morning. We got a phone. Have we changed our mind now? Mm. So that was happening all the time, where we were just about to sign the fucking deal, you know. Another time we were signing a deal, we had a guy called, this just before Danny Kenny, this other guy was managing us anyway, and he rang me from the airport on the way over to London to meet the record company. He said, "Man, I can't handle it, I'm a lean alcoholic, I wouldn't be able to handle it." So he just lost it. It was the pressure got too much for him, and he's an alcoholic, and he said, "I have to leave, I can't do it."
Yeah.
And he's on his way over to fucking discuss the record, just, you know. So we'd loads of mad shit like that, you know. So then, eventually, we got signed to EMI, you know.
Can you tell me about... were you like fucking really ambitious at that point? Yeah. Were you like the driver?
Well, we used to rehearse after Alan's thing, right? It started getting too loud and too big to be in Alan's garage, because his garage was tiny, right? Mm. So there was this on the run where the new runway is on the airport. There used to be an old farmhouse there, and there was a redundant pigsty.
Yeah,
and the people that lived on the farm allowed us to use this pigsty.
Yeah.
Now it was just like fucking 9-inch blocks with a corrugated tin roof. Do you know what I mean? It used to be fucking bitter cold in the winter and stuff. We used to go from Ballymun. We'd leave the gear in Ballymun in fucking shopping trolleys, wheel it from Ballymun to there every day bar Sunday at 9 o'clock in the morning in fucking rain, snow, anything. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. So we used to do that every day. We'd be in rehearsal. I used to leave at about 1 o'clock. I'd go into town, have a singing lesson till about 3 o'clock, come back and then work till 5 o'clock with the band. Mm. So it was absolute dedication. Mm. You know
and
what
when
I mean?
Did you start singing lessons?
I was doing it for fucking 14 years or 13 years. So I would have started when in my 20s or something like that, early 20s.
That's unusual, isn't it, for a singer of pop or rock
bands? Well, so I used to go, some singing teachers I used to go to, from the time as a kid I started looking, because I wanted to get the best out of I could be, do you know what I mean? Mm. I was always pursuing excellence. Now, you know you're never going to achieve that, do you know what I mean? But the pursuit of it is going to raise your standards a little bit.
Did it?
Like, absolutely, absolutely. It's helped me in the, you know, now.
Your voice is amazing, yeah.
Well, you kind of understand singing. And again, what I was saying earlier, it's about getting back to who you are, do you know what I mean? And getting rid of all these other idioms. And that's the thing. You see, when you're expressing an emotion through a song, if you're doing it in somebody else's idiom, you're being a pale imitation of that person. So it's harder for the audience to identify or to connect with that. But when you're giving a real emotion from a real place, the audience are going to connect with that, I think. And that's what I learned about singing. The singing I studied was bel canto. It's like what Pavarotti does, all that kind of. I've just had to be doing a singing lesson with that guy, Mark, just before you got here. So we had that kind of dedication to be successful, you know.
So when you're live on stage, because you know, the intensity of your performance is probably, I think, what draws most people to see.
I don't know.
I think it is. I mean, you seem to be... Do you actually lose yourself?
You know what it is.
You're not like...
Joe, I'll tell you what it is, right? I think we all have a little bit of idiot in us. We all have a little bit of woman in us, you know, feminine qualities. Mm. We have all these different little parts of us that we can't really expose to the world, or we're called faggots or fucking idiots or whatever. So when you're on a stage, you can kind of just totally let all your inhibitions go and just be exactly who you want to be, do you know what I mean, for that hour and a half or something. And that's what I get out of being on stage, do you know what I mean? So, like, people say to me, you know, why do you do this or why do you do that? And I don't know. I really don't know, because I don't know what I do on stage. Do you know what I mean? Mm. From one thing to the next, people say to me, that was mad the way you fucking jumped over the speaker that day. I couldn't even remember that. Do you know what I mean? Mm. I just get lost in the whole thing.
But would you say in any way that it might have been an escape, and that's why you wanted to do it? Is it an escape from things that happened in your life when you were young?
Yeah. Yeah,
and would that have spurred you on?
It would be that. Like, yeah. There's loads of, like, everything that happens. I believe everything that happens in your life. I'm a bit of a Freudian, you know. Mm. I believe everything that happens in your early life manifests in your later life. You know, I was raped when I was a kid. I was raped twice when I was 6 years of age, when I was 9 years of age, by two different people. Mm. So that obviously fucked a lot with my head. Do you know what I mean? My sexuality was totally fucked up when I was coming into my adolescence and all that. Mm. So all of those things, you know, all of those. You know, I had eight kids in the family. I was the second eldest, so from being the most important person in the house, like, a year later I wasn't, and then every year after that there was somebody else taking it. So you have all these insecurities, all that. Mm. So then you're looking for approval, and you look all these things. Mm. That's what you're doing when you're getting on the stage, I think, you know. Mm. But as well as that, like, there's a reason that I chose singing to do it, as opposed to being a comic or an actor or a ballet fucking whatever. That's you right. know. So I loved singing as well. So it was fortunate that I loved singing, so I could express myself through that.
You say it's looking for attention, but it's also an escape, isn't it?
Yes, from, that's what I mean.
Whatever pain you might be.
Oh, absolutely, 100%.
Yeah.
Absolutely, because you can be yourself. Because when you're in normal life, all those things that happen to you, that pain is there, you know. That's colouring everything that you do. So when you're on stage for that couple of hours, you don't have all those things. They're not fucking colouring what you do. So it's an escape from that, you know. You're free of those chains for that 2 hours. Do you know what I mean?
But at the end of the day, I don't know if it's a good solution.
It's not a solution.
No.
Absolutely it's not, but it's an escape for 2 hours.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
And is that what would have been that...
I mean, I wouldn't have consciously thought that.
No, of course not. I'm just looking back on it now. So, I mean, I think there's kind of a double-edged thing. You know what I mean? I think I can see it in my own self. That's possibly what spurred me on to be a performer, because I'm a shy person.
So am I.
But I wanted to get on stage.
Yeah, so am I. I'm very shy out in the world. Like, growing up, I met Catherine when I was 14. Like, she was one of my first girlfriends, and I married her, you know.
Yeah.
So I hadn't even got experience in that world, do you know what I mean? Mm. You know, going out dating and all that shy, because I was way off from the time I was 14. Mm. But I was extremely shy, you know, and I used to sing in my bare feet for years and years. Mm. And the reason I did it was, the first gig I was talking about in the Ballymun Towers, I was fucking terrified. I was so terrified and so kind of nervous and shy, if you like. I stood there for the whole gig, and just in one spot, my hands were white at the end of the thing, so just holding the mic. So after, I said I wouldn't do that again. So I used to walk around the stage, but I'd be tripping over guitar leads and stuff. So then I started I used to take my shoes off so I could feel the leads as I was walking, because my eyes would be closed, you know, because if I opened them and looked at the audience, I'd shit myself, do you know what I mean? So I used to close my eyes and I could feel my way around with me bare feet, you know, so... That's how it
But anyway, I just think, anyway, whatever that intensity is, I think that's what really, it's not even in the lyrics, it's in just the way you're saying, you know what I mean? I know there are great lyrics, but people can really feel something. I don't know whether it's just there.
Well, like, you know, apart, Bowie writes great lyrics and great melodies, but he has something else as well, do you know what I mean? There's the Bowie thing. So, you know, even when you were asking earlier on about why we got these crowds, I never wanted to analyse that, because I think if you did, you'd start contriving it then, do you know what I mean? And it wouldn't be real anymore, you know? Yeah. So I try just leave that and just accept that it's there and be grateful that it's there, do you know what I mean? But I don't really investigate it a lot, you know?
And then at what point did you start dabbling in heroin?
I didn't start that till my daughter was born, so it would have been about 28 or something like that before I started. But both of my grandfathers were alcoholics and literally keeled over in pubs, you know, just boom. Heavy chronic alcoholics. So my parents never drank. So drink was a bit of a no-no in the family, and the stories and the course. So I was never into drink, and I never liked to drink what I did to Irish society, you know, the whole gag. I never liked that. So as a young teenager, say 18 or whatever, I used to start getting into hash and that, you know, the usual. Now, so I was into drug culture, and unfortunately, because you have to go into, you know, dodgy places to get hash, and like the first time I got heroin, I used to score off this biker over in Rathmines, and one day I went, he said, "I've no hash, but I've got skag there." And I was afraid to say I didn't know what skag was. Yeah. So yeah, give us that, you know. So he gave it to me, and it was in a little bindle, you know, a little wrap. And I was looking at what you get for a tenner towards what you got in hash for a tenner. I said, "Yeah, you're fucking ripping me off." I said, "What do you do with this?" He says, "Snort it." And I snorted it, and, you know, I thought, "Oh, fuck yeah, I'm home." Right.
Straight off, first time.
Absolutely. Now, I've tried, I have drank, do you know what I mean, when I was a young fella. I tried hash, I tried acid, I tried coke, I tried speed, I tried them all, right? And I liked, you know, don't get me wrong, I got something out of every one of them, right? But I had this hole inside, this like gnawing emptiness. Do you know when you're starving and you have a kind of empty, kind of hollow kind of thing in your stomach? Well, I've had that all my life, always had it. And the first day I took heroin, it was gone.
Yeah.
I'll never forget it. And I just felt, I'm fucking home. I thought, this is how Joe Rooney wakes up in the morning. This is how Catherine wakes up in the morning. This is how this is the way I should feel. John, this is the way it should be. And that hole was gone. And I just felt, I didn't feel high or stoned. I felt normal, you know. And so the next day I had a choice. So you kind of tell yourself the lie. Think of it this way. Imagine if it takes exactly 28 days to get addicted to heroin. Well, I kind of told myself, I'll do it for exactly 27 days. I'll stop the day before I'm going to get... Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's the lie.
So
you kind
did you take your heroin the next day after?
No, I didn't. No, I wouldn't have took it then for fucking probably 2 years after that. Okay. Do you know what I mean? Okay. So then... You know, it took me a while to recognise that, do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, the first day it happened, I thought that was brilliant, do you know what I mean? But, you know, you go back to a thing. But then, you know, you deal with two days in a row, then three, and then eventually, one day, we were going off to Germany, we were gigging, and I just felt fucking shite, do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So I thought I had the flu, we came back, we were touring, and we finished the German thing, and we came back, we were in Birmingham, in England. And I said to Danny, I says, "You're going to have to get a doctor." I says, "I feel fucking shite, you know." So they got the doctor. The doctor came up and says, "I can't see anything wrong with you, you know. There's fuck all wrong with you, you don't know. Probably a bit of a flu." So the next day, we had a gig in Waterford. So I rang a mate of mine. I said, "Listen," I says, "we're playing in Waterford tomorrow." I says, "Will you bring down a bit of gear for me, you know?" So he brought a bit of gear down. So I was in the... I was kind of hanging together, you know. We did a gig in Waterford. And... they were having a signing kind of thing after signing autographs for these kids and that. So I went into my room with this guy, you know, and I went in like, and I came somersaults out the bleeding door, you know, where's these fucking autographs? You know? Yeah. So the band seeing this, and there was murder, you know, this fuck off, you know, you were hanging together. So they knew, that's when I found out I was strung out, you know.
You didn't even know that you were addicted.
No, I didn't know. And so the whole thing came to a head anyway, and there was murder, we were splitting up that day, I'll never forget it. So I said, "Look, I'm sorry," you know. So I thought I could just stop, do you know what I mean? But it's, you know, the way heroin is.
But you were just smoking it.
Yeah.
You never went to...
No, I did, eventually, but that time I hadn't, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, Jesus, yeah. I remember being in Bray, in a Jack's in Bray, in the old, you know, the public Jack's on the beach, on the promenade, right? There's a Jack's there, right?
Yeah.
So I went into the men's Jack's, there was no mirror, so I went into the ladies' Jack's. All my veins are gone from years of abusing them, right? So I used to go into my neck, and I'm in the Jack's, right? In the fucking ladies' Jack's, and I'm like this with a syringe into me jugular vein, and these two Owens walked in, really old, two old women, and they kind of, jeez, and I thought, ah, fucking don't be overreacting, it's only, and I was honestly thought these were overreacting, you know, it's probably the most horrific thing they've ever seen in their lives, do you know what I mean, but I was so lost in that fucking world, do you know what I mean, they really thought, yeah, I know it's not a nice life, but don't be giving it all, that's not that fucking bad, you know, madness,
just you, that was not
that's the insanity of addiction, you know, so it got horrendous, you know, but it didn't start off, like it started off, as I said, you know, just, you know, Mickey Mousing around, and like, I seen Kojak when I was a kid, you know, I know what I heard of it, but I thought, that's never going to happen to me, do you know what I mean,
right, yeah. And that kind of screwed up the, you know, when you got to your deal with EMI, would you say that it was the heroin that kind of screwed up?
It wouldn't have helped, do you know what I mean? Yeah. But I don't think it was, some people gave it more credence than it deserved. Because, you know, what we were doing at the time, you look at Oasis, do you know what I mean? They were celebrated what we were being crucified for 10 years earlier. Do you know what I mean? Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like they were, remember, the I don't know if you've seen the movie, the Supernova thing. They went to LA, the first thing to LA, and they thought you were buying coke, but you bought crystal meth. So they were up for 3 days, and they went on stage, and they were all playing different fucking songs. This was their first gig in LA. I mean, we never got that bad, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Never got anything close to that. Like, I used to keep all that till after the gig. I'd go off and get something or whatever. Yeah. But I tried to not let it affect the thing. Now, eventually it did, because obviously, you know, you weren't as productive as you would have been. Mm. But, you know, it wasn't, that wouldn't have been, it was how we handled it was what the problem was.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So that's kind of, the band fucked
me out.
Would
have been a strong anti-drug thing in other members of the band?
They were all doing coke.
They were doing coke.
Do you know what I mean? We went to America.
Yeah.
And we fucking snorted our way through America. And we came back. And I couldn't stop. Do you know what I mean? The rest of the band's right, let's go back to work. And I was an addict, do you know what I mean?
Mm.
Because of all whatever went on in my life up to that point, you know?
Mm.
So that's the irony of the whole thing. That's what I thought. How can you fuck me out for drugs, man? You're bleeding savages, the whole lot of you. Anyway, that's neither here nor there.
Well, it's there.
Yeah, it's there, yeah. It is there, yeah.
I don't know, when was the first time you tried to stop, or...
Jesus, I can't even remember.
No.
The day I in Waterford, that would have been the first time I tried to stop the next day, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then I tried a million times after that, you know. Eventually, I went over to a place called Thamprabok in Thailand. And you go into this, it's up in the north Thailand, in the jungle. And it's a Buddhist monastery, and you're in a gated compound.
Mm.
And you go in and you take your money off you and your clothes and your passport and all that, and you're given this pink kind of uniform thing. So if you escape out to the outs, people in the villages will know you've escaped from this. So they'll fucking drag you back in again. So you've no money anyway, so there's no point in escaping, you'd starve. So to give you, on the compound, there's like Monopoly money it's just valid on the compound, you know, so you can buy kind of pineapples and cigarettes and stuff out of it. But you were just put in a dormitory and you signed a waiver when you went in that if you died, it wasn't their responsibility, and that, you know, if you died during the detox. So the abbot in the monastery had developed this drink. It was made out of all these spices and herbs and shit. And you used to drink, there was basically 20 of us kneeling in a row, and there was a gutter in front of you and a bucket of water beside each person. So you drank this drink and then you drank a load of water. And about 5 minutes later, I just started vomiting, like fucking profusely, projectile vomiting. And it got all the toxins supposedly out of your system, you know. Mm. But I remember, like, I'd go back into the dormitory to lie down, and used to come in and put a mirror up to see if I was still alive, you know. It's like, I was fucking in bits. At that, you know. So,
do you think that was too much, or was that...
It was hardcore, you know.
Yeah.
Now, there's a lot to be said, you know. I believe methadone is a great thing, you know. I think it's a great thing. It can be abused, obviously, you know. If it's not treated right, it can be abused, like anything can be abused. But it is a great, softer way of getting you off drugs, do you know what I mean? But sometimes, for some people, they need... It needs to be hardcore for them not to do it again. Do you know what I mean? So I tried loads of soft options and didn't seem to be working for me. So I thought, well, this is a bit hardcore. Maybe this will work. So that was kind of what...
But what about the initial problem? Is that not what needs to be sorted
out?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, you have to get back to that. But you see, you have to stop to be able to go back to that.
Right.
Do you understand?
Okay.
So that's where the NA thing came in. Do you know what I mean? I start going to NA and all that carry on. So in NA, the 12 steps get you to look at, you know, yourself, you know, and look at the reasons you do things and your behaviour. It's all about behaviour. Like, addiction is all about feelings. Mm. It's about, you have a feeling and you want to change it to another feeling, you know, by using a drug to do that, as opposed to using a joke to do it, or a song to do it, or a story. Do you know what I mean?
Mm.
It's all right to do it in a healthy way, but it's not good to do it in a chemical way, you know, by taking some chemical like alcohol or
ecstasy or something.
Or heroin or whatever the fuck, you know. So you have to get to the, obviously you have to get to the reasons. So I had to investigate all this rape shit that happened when I was a kid. And
you did that through NA? Or did you go to a counsellor?
I did it through NA. Well, you do it yourself, do you know what I mean? You have to work on it yourself. But it was NA that gave me the tools to be able to investigate.
Yeah.
And you know, maybe I could still probably do a Gomer counsellor if I'm totally honest, you know what I mean? Because there's still a lot of shit there. Mm-hmm. But I have cancer and I have no great fucking desire to get into all that, you know? I just want to get on with it, you know?
Are you happy now, would you say?
I'm very happy, yeah.
Are you?
Yeah. Yeah, I have three grandkids. I have a daughter, I have three grandkids. I have a lovely wife. Mm. I'm happy where I am, you know. You know, I've nothing to be unhappy about, you know what I mean? Mm. I've had a really good life. I've had a really, you know, varied life, a very colourful life, you know. Mm. I've been all over the world. You know, what the fuck else can you have? I mean, I could have a bigger house. People say, Aslan should have been this and you should have been that. That's all bollocks, you know what I mean? I was saying this, we did that Tommy Tiernan show a few weeks ago, and I was saying this, I would much rather today have written Crazy World and This Is, right, those two songs just, and then sang a great version of fucking some song, somebody else's song.
A cover,
and be famous, like Boyzone or something, and have made millions. Do you know what I mean? I would rather be, you know, when I go to my grave, I'd rather be who I am than be a millionaire who sang other people's songs.
Oh, yeah. And
because that's what's important to me. That's not to say that they're wrong and I'm right. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Do you know, that's what their right is. That's what's right for Ronan Keating or fucking whatever. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, but you probably chose a more difficult path by wanting to do originally.
Yeah, and, you know, that's the path I chose, and that's the path they chose, and that's cool.
Yeah, you have to live with your own thing. Yeah. And I was just wondering though about, I was actually talking to Jimmy Smith. He's the Bogey Boys. Do you remember the Bogey Boys?
I know Jimmy Smith. Yeah.
Right. He was talking about the difference between him having to be in a band and maybe yourselves, who are working class lads and having to survive, than maybe the Edge, who may have. Like, he said that he was backstage when you two were doing a gig and they were trying to get signed, and the A&R man had walked out after their first song, and the Edge said, "Geez, if we don't get signed in the next year, my parents are going to make me go back to college." And he was looking at him going, I have to work for a living, you know what
yeah
I mean?
Well,
do you know what I mean? I don't want to put the Edge down, he's a lovely fella, I'm sure, but
what's
do you know what
that?
I mean, it's hard
The Edge hadn't got a lot of talent as a guitar player, but he's made huge fucking strides and huge inroads in what the little bit of talent he had, and I can't take that away from him.
I'm just saying.
You two are one of the best things ever come out of this country musically, and a lot of people are jealous of that. And I can understand why Jimmy would be jealous. Jimmy is a ridiculous musician. Mm. He's a hugely talented musician,
I don't think he said he was jealous. Now, I don't. No, in fairness.
But that sounds to me like there's
envy. What he's saying is the difficulty in, he called it some highfalutin thing like constructionism or something. Anyway,
I don't know.
Well, basically, that you've got to make a living. If you're a working class fella or girl.
I understand
So you got to kind of balance that with trying to make a bit of art.
Yeah.
But you still got to make a living. Yeah. So you convinced,
it was a lot easier for
you convinced
yeah,
the rest
I understand.
Of the band to give up their jobs.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying and I agree with you. And I agree with Jimmy Smith. There was that, you know. Some people had it a lot easier than we would have, you know. Mm. And even down to, you know, the Hot House Flowers could speak Irish. So they kind of got in with RTA, which helped, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
All that carry on. You know, so there's always, money always fucking helps, always. Do you know what I mean? In any field. You know, I always look at it this way, right? I don't know how many show jumping potential tennis champions,
yeah,
a show jumping chance were born in Finglas or Ballymun. Because you're never exposed to it, so we never know. Do you understand?
Yeah, absolutely. I agree totally with you.
So it's a lot easier. You know, these people, you know, they usually go to skills that are, you know, if they're really good skills, they can kind of recognise a talent early on and, you know, capitalise and, you know, on that talent and bring that talent out. So money always helps, you know what I mean? And it's just the way it is. That's the way the art is.
Yeah, I that's what I'm trying to say. It's that money. Like, there's a lot of this new kind of idea. If you say to yourself, "I can be that,"
visualising, and all that. Oh, Jesus, right. That's all bullshit.
But if you come up in the wrong area, it's tougher.
Yeah, of course. Like, you know, Conor McGregor is into that visualisation. Yeah. You know, and you know, I can understand it. You know, it worked for him in fighting. You can't kick your way to the top of the pops or kick your way to the fuck to a Grammy. Or you can't kick your way to an Oscar or punch your way to an Oscar. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Or you can't joke your way to a fucking... Do you understand? So it all depends on the medium you choose in your visualisation. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I don't really agree with that totally because, you know, some bloke and fingers could have visualised all he fucking liked about being the Wimbledon champion. Mm. But the chances of it ever happening were fucking slim. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. You know, and he would have had to do a lot more visualisation than other people that were born in fucking...
Yeah, you know. I'm not saying you can't do it. But,
it is, it's possible, but you know, everything's relative, isn't it? Yeah, do you know what I mean? Yeah.
I was just thinking, though, as well, like, you know when... the way it is now with the music industry, like there probably wouldn't be exactly. So you got to deal with EMI, you got to tour America and do all that shit. No band's going to get that now, are they?
And that's great, you know. Yeah. Not great that it's not happening, but it's great that we got in there before the whole thing ended, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Because now records, you see, the record companies don't matter anymore because records don't matter anymore.
Yeah.
For example, we released an album, the album just before that, and it cost us 90 grand to record the album, right? Yeah. So we pay for it, finance everything ourselves now. We don't have a record company anymore to finance. Right. Now, we use a record company to distribute the album because they have the distribution network. But we actually, to keep artistic control over the music, we pay for it, we do ourselves, because we found that when you're with a record company, they want you to sound like this and they give you this producer, it changes who you are and you end up with a product that you're not happy with and stuff like that. So we found this way was better for us. So anyway, it cost us 90 grand to record the album. In the first 2 weeks, we sold £40,000 worth of albums and there was £250,000 worth downloaded illegally. The first 2 weeks of the fucking launch.
Yeah.
So, you know, the only point in making a record today is to keep your profile.
It's just like an ad or something.
Exactly. Yeah. That's all it is. It's not like an ad. It is an ad. Mm. Do you know what I mean? Mm. It's to keep your profile up there and let people know what you're doing. Do you know what I mean? What kind of music you're doing. But as regards...
And even selling, like, say, Bowie, you were talking about how little Bowie had sold up to that...
Yeah, up to the internet.
Let's Dance, say.
Yeah, yeah.
Or whatever. Like, he would never have got to develop now, would he?
No. Absolutely. Listen, there would be no Bob Dylan today. There would be no Elton John today.
Yeah.
None of those people would exist today. Years ago, they used to sign on development deals. Even U2, when they were signed, they weren't expected to kick it off on their first album.
Yeah.
They were kind of on their second. The record company would have been looking for their second or third album for it to happen. Let them develop, you know. Mm. No such thing. You make an album now, and if it's not number 5 in the fucking chart, you're dropped the next day. Do you know what I mean? I've seen these programs on TV, these boy band things and all. And like, you see a man, he put a band together, a boy band. This is the guy that used to manage New Kids on the Block.
Yeah.
So he had a thing called Forming the Band. It was a documentary thing on the telly. So they formed this band. He auditioned hundreds of singers, the usual show. Got a band together, kind of got them in, got songwriters in, wrote the song, got stylists in, stylized the band, gave them their image, everything was there, band looked great, sounded great, released the record. So they're waiting for it to go on the charts and it's gone up to fucking 14. If it doesn't get to 10, and it didn't, you're fucking sacked.
Yeah,
next day, you know.
It's bizarre because I would have thought,
so there'll never be another Bowie.
A lot of people used to hate the record companies, do you know what I mean? But now looking back on it, you think, it
did serve a purpose, yeah. See, because what happened is a lot of record companies, although they had a lot of faults and a lot of shite and there was a lot of bollocks, a lot of the people were people that were in bands, do you know what I mean, who didn't succeed in bands but wanted to stay in the music industry and became A&R men. Then they became fucking... Mm. managers of different record companies, and I formed their own little record company because we didn't like what was happening in big record companies. So we had all your independent record companies for different types of music.
Like, I was reading or I was listening to a podcast about Bowie, and even after he's released The Man Who Sold the World, I think, didn't sell that much, but the record company flew him over to New York and he met Lou Reed and Andy Warhol and all that. I mean, how would he do that now, you know?
No, it wouldn't happen.
It wouldn't.
It wouldn't happen now.
And that inspired him, you
absolutely,
know,
and, yeah. All those things made him who he was, you know, and he developed as an artist.
And even probably Lou Reed wasn't selling any records either.
Lou Reed would have never sold a record without Bowie. Iggy Pop would have never sold a record, probably, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
He, as well as them helping his career, he fucking launched their careers, do you know what I mean? He launched a lot of people's careers. That whole mix and bowl, you know, it was very healthy, and record companies did that then, and you know, like we are put in with different people, you know, so it's very healthy, you know. Like, one thing, the record company, when we were at EMI, the first album, I Love This Is The Sea, the Waterboys album, the Hole of the Moon and all on it. And Carl Wallinger was in the band then. He had a band called World Party after that. I don't know if you remember him. But he was one of the main people, as well as Mike
Scott.
He was main songwriter in the Waterboys. So I heard that album and I thought this production, and I just loved it. It was nice and raw and edgy, and so a guy called Mick Glossop done it. So we said, we want this guy, Mick Glossop. They were saying, they were trying to put us with a whammy type.
Really?
Producer. And Billy had the black hair, or blonde hair, and I had the black hair. It looked black and white fucking Scotch whiskey. They were almost, you know, trying to promote.
Yeah.
I said, fuck that, no way, we're not going that way. So you have that, you have to fight against that sort of
shit. That was the side of the record company that was a bit, you had to fight against, but then
absolutely,
the other side.
But then the other side was very good, you know. Yeah. Like, they gave us the money to go over and tour America, you know. We toured with Stiff Little Fingers. We'd done a tour of Europe with Stiff Little Fingers. They gave us the money to be able to do that, because you have to buy onto these tours, you know. You people think you get onto these tours and
that you're getting paid, but no, you're actually paying to get on.
we toured with Graham Parker in America. It cost us 60 grand to tour America with him, and you know, it cost 80 grand in the end, but we got 60 grand initially off the record company. So all those things are possible, plus we could get Mick Glossop and produce the album, because like he charges what, £2,000 a day. You couldn't afford to do that now. Do you know what I mean? So they pay for all that, you know. Now you're paying for it eventually, but they loan you. A record company's like a bank. So they loan you the money.
So
to
an
do
advance
that
is something you have to pay back.
Oh, absolutely.
Well, if you make money, you'll pay it back.
Yeah.
If and you don't make any money,
and you have to sell a lot of records to make money, you know. Because when you see, it's what people don't understand is, right, when you sell a record, only probably fivepence out of that record is yours. So only that fivepence goes off your bill. Like the fucking €13 doesn't go off your bill.
No.
Do you understand what I mean?
Yeah, right.
So it takes a long time to pay that money back. And they have that sus,
you
know.
Are you paying for the limos as well and all that?
Everything. Yeah. Every fucking thing. Listen, I tell you. We had a guy called Bud Prager, right? He used to manage Foreigner. And he was managing us for a while. So we met him over in New York, right?
Yeah.
And one of the days we were meeting him, he had a huge office and all that. He managed Benny King. He managed a lot of big artists. But I couldn't make it this day. I was fucking dying with the flu, right? So I stayed. I was living in an apartment in New York. So I'm in the apartment anyway. And one of the lads came back with a bowl of chicken soup and says, Bud's daughter, who worked for him, said, this is really good chicken broth. It'll help you with your cold. Why, we got a fucking bill for it.
Yeah?
We got a bill for the fucking cup of soup. Fucking animals. So, you know, for fuck's sake.
And how did you travel around America? Were you flying from place to place? Was it by tour bus?
Tour bus and flying. Both, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
We flew over and then we bussed. It was great.
Tour bus?
Oh, it was fucking great.
Was it, yeah?
Absolutely fantastic. Fantastic. Like a sleeper bus, you know, you could sleep on it. But it's just, I mean, I was in more of America than most Americans were, do you know what I mean? Like, I remember reading a statistic that 30% or 80% of Americans have never been 30 miles outside the radius of where they are born.
Yes.
You know, that's why they're so fucked up, you know. That's why they vote for Trump.
Yeah.
But, you know, I've seen the whole of America, you know, and driving, you know, down fucking all these motor highways and shit like that, and going to these little, you know, with the truck stops and just all that. Just the whole thing was great. I remember we were playing in Detroit, right? And in the place, the street that it was on was at about 9 o'clock, it was like a real scummy area, right?
Yeah.
And a police car and a line of policemen went up the street, and all the drug dealers, you could look out the window of the gig, right, when he went into the gig. When we pulled up at the gig, a bloke came out with a gun and stood at the fucking van with a gun, an armed guard, while you were loading the gear in, because the blokes would come up and just take the gear off you, the scumbags, right? So they're all selling. You could see them selling drugs on the corners and all, which is handy. But when this sweep came up, right, at about 9 o'clock, this sweep came up the street. It was like Leeson Street after 9 o'clock. Then all these fucking cars start pulling up, like fucking Jags and Porsches and all this, you know, pulling up, and all these people getting out, coming into all the clubs and into where we were playing as well. Do you know what I mean? So I went out. I said, this is fucking deadly. So I went out before we went on, and I'm sitting on the steps with the bouncers, you know, and this bloke pulls up in a fucking in a Porsche, and he gets out, and this young bloke was just walking by, and your man gets out of the car and he does this. See, a man just takes the fucking keys, and he looked over at us to see, and he's gone to, your man thought he was the valet, you know. He just gets into your man's Porsche and he's fucking gone. We're sitting there pissing ourselves laughing. Your man thought he was, oh, it was fucking great. But just stuff, the stuff you see, you know. I remember we were playing in New York, and I went outside to this bloke. He was outside, and he's had to been there. I was fucking, there was snow. New York, and have you ever been in New York in the winter?
In winter,
it's
yeah, the snow.
It's
yeah.
fucking cold. Yeah. This bloke was sitting outside the venue all night, all day. As we were setting up right through to the gig at late at night, he was still fucking out with a cup, begging, you know. So I went out to him, and I was talking to him. I fucking felt terrible sorry for him. I ended up going off and scoring with him. I said, come here, you don't know where I get a bit of gear, do you? He says, yeah. He said, I don't take gear, so I take crack. I said, well, look, I'll buy you some crack if you fucking get us some gear, you know. So the two of us went out in a taxi and we got it. But I was talking to him then, and I said, how the fuck, you know, did you end up like sitting on the fucking street all day? He was married, he was a carpenter, and he was married to this board, right? And it was our birthday, so we came home early to give her a surprise and caught her in bed with this bloke. Marriage broke up, she fucked him out, and he just kind of went on a bit of a bender and then fell through the cracks. And in America, there's no social welfare system, so if you go through the cracks, it's very fucking hard to get back up again, do you know what I mean? That was it, he was fucked. But I'll tell you a funny story about New York, right? When I was living in New York, when we split from Aslan, I was with Dick Conagoff, a thing called Dignam and Goff, and we went off to America. I was living in New York for about a year. So we're gigging all around the East Coast of America and stuff. So I scored down in Alphabet City every, you know, I scored my gear, you know. And I scored off this bloke. And one day he says to me, instead of getting 10 bags, dime bags, they call them, you know, he says, well, don't you get like a gram? It'd be much cheaper for you to buy a bit of weight, you know what I mean? So I said, well, can you get me a gram? He said, yeah, no problem, you know. So the next day, met him, and I gave him $150 or something, and he gave me the gram of gear, you know. So we opened it, and see, heroin here is brown. Heroin here is brown. Yeah. The heroin in America is white.
It's
white, you know. So I wet my finger and done that, and it starts sizzling on my tongue. I said, this is fucking Andrew's liver cells. So this was a big fucker, you know, because like over 6 foot. I went, oi! And your man ran, right? So I fucking ran after him. So I'm running through fucking New York, through Alphabet. He ran into the projects, which would be the Ballymun of fucking New York. I'm running after him. And next minute, I'm looking, I'm the only white fucker in the whole place. Everybody's black. And the two of us just must have had an epiphany at the same moment where he said, what am I running from this prick for? And I said, what am I going to do if I catch this fucker?
Yeah.
So he turns around, he's just like a cartoon, he's fucking chasing me out of the place. Fucking crazy shit, you know. Mad shit.
Fucking hell.
Mad. Just thought of that there. Funny story.
And do you think is it possible you could be
psychopath?
Psychopath. No. No, that you could just live and be... No. And take heroin, and just if you had kept your habit under.
I thought that.
If you're saying $150 a week.
Yeah. But you see, addiction is a progressive disease.
Yeah.
So it progresses. So apart from the fact that your tolerance will build. So if $10 would do you for a day today, in a month's time, $50 you'd need for a day is geared. You know what I mean?
Right, okay.
So it keeps going up. Plus, you as a human being deteriorate as your addiction progresses. Do you know what I mean? You want more and more. So it wouldn't work. It just, I thought that myself. I thought if people just allowed me to just... I'll earn my own money. I don't have to go out robbed. Do you know what I mean? I can earn my money. I can get enough heroin to keep me going. If my wife accepts and everybody accepts it. But you're going to be sitting there goofing out. Do you know what I mean? It doesn't work. It's in an ideal world. Now, I do believe that when people are trying to come off heroin and they go into a methadone course... Methadone stops you craving for heroin.
Yeah.
Now, you don't really get a stone out of it. There's no... But it can stabilise you long enough for you to be able to try and help yourself. And you can detox easier off methadone than you can.
What is the length of time it takes for the withdrawal to...
It's a piece of string, you know. You know, I remember stopping one time and I didn't sleep for a month. A whole month. I didn't sleep one fucking minute for a month. Because, you know... Heroin, you know.
You're getting all aches and stuff?
You're in a lot. You get all, see, heroin's a muscle relaxant, right? But it also, how it's the reason it's so hard to stop taking it is you have endorphin glands in your body, right? As you know. So when you stub your toe or if you want to have a shit and all these pains that you'd get through your body, as soon as they happen to you, to a normal person, your endorphin gland kicks in and floods you with endorphins to help you through that moment.
If you stub your toe or whatever.
So when you take heroin, every day you tell the endorphin gland, we don't need you, we have our own source. So eventually your endorphin gland shuts down. So when you stop taking heroin, then this thing is not working anymore. So you feel all those little aches and pains and fucking... Plus, heroin is an anaesthetic almost. You know what I mean? It stops feeling pain. So when you haven't felt pain for a long time, you haven't felt emotions for a long time. So when you stop, you come back with a fucking vengeance. Do you know what I mean? Like, I remember stopping and singing... Well, I was doing a gig one day and I was singing the song Crazy World, actually. And Catherine was in the audience. And I just caught her. My eye just kind of caught her for how can I protect you in this crisis? Just that line. And I just thought, you haven't been, you prick. You haven't been protecting. You haven't been fucking doing what you should be doing as a whole. And I lost it. At the time, I was only at the stop in 2 weeks, maybe. So I was still in kind of a bit of withdrawals, you know what I mean? So things like that.
On stage, you lost it.
Yeah. I had to get Billy to take over the song. I just fucking lost it. I just started bawling my eyes out on stage. So, you know, all that shit, you know. That's what makes it so hard.
Like trouble you that you weren't around for your kids, maybe sometimes.
Yes, of course.
Yeah.
Oh fuck! When I got the cancer, you know, I was in hospital, and I was going through all my life, you know, and I remember my daughter coming up, and she was there, you know, and I just cried for maybe 2 days. Do you know what I mean? Just apologising to her and telling her I was so sorry for fucking all the insecurities I fucking gave her because she didn't think she was worth the love that I wasn't given her, you know what I'm saying? So all those things that she's inherited because of me, and I can see them, do you know what I mean? And you know, that's horrifying, do you know what I mean? That's probably you know, even now thinking about it, it's bad. That's something I'll never get over, and it's something I can't undo. It's all I can do is be a better person today, do you know what I mean? But that, even saying that, that's very logic, do you know what I mean? But when I go to bed and I'm lying in bed at night and I think of that shit, that hurts, you know what I mean? I don't like that about myself, you know. That's one I fucked up big time, you know.
Talk to her about it, haven't
you? I apologize. And she says, look, it doesn't matter, you know, you were the best you could be at that time and all. But that doesn't do anything. That doesn't make me feel, you know, it makes me feel a bit better. But I still feel like a cunt. I still, you know, I don't have a lot of regrets in my life of things I've done. Do you know what I mean? I don't even regret becoming an addict because it helped me who I am. But I do regret things like that, you know what I mean? That I fucking did, you know, I wasn't who I should have been for my family, you know?
That's a big deal. And you can't go back.
I can't. So that fucking... And it only came to... It only, as I said, when I got the cancer that time and I was in hospital... I was evaluating everything, you know? And that was the biggest... thing that was my biggest upset in life and my biggest fucking regret, you know. So
yeah,
all the logical fucking explanation and doesn't
you can't even, when you think about it, you can't, what happened to you as a kid, there's nothing you could have done.
Yeah.
And then that leads on but to
even
the next
that,
thing.
That, even yeah. that, even knowing that doesn't help, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It will help a little bit, you know what I mean? And the fact that Catherine and Ciara would forgive you, you know, helps a little bit, but it's still, you still feel like a tool, you know, so... That's that.
No. Mm. Anyway, on that bombshell.
as Clarkson would say. I used to hate that show, and I only got into it recently. It's fucking deadly.
Partridge?
No.
Alan Partridge?
No, Clarkson.
Oh, yeah. That's Top Gear, yeah.
Alan Partridge's a genius.
Yeah. He used to say that as well. On that bombshell.
Oh, does he?
Yeah.
He's fucking great. He is great.
Yeah, he's amazing. He's brilliant, yeah.
Brilliant. Steve Coogan.
Yeah, he's brilliant. Okay, well, listen, I suppose I won't keep you any longer unless you want to keep talking.
No, that's cool. If you're happy, I'm happy. We ended on a happy
note.
You want
your kitchen back? And Charlie's looking.
Jack.
Jack,
he's calling you Charlie.
Yeah, sorry.
What is Charlie on your mind?
I was up with Eric Lawler. His dog's called Charlie, actually. That's what it is.
Right, okay.
It's not Charlie. well, listen,
cool.
I haven't met you. Well, I've only met you that time at Slane briefly, but it's been great.
Yeah, I enjoyed that myself, actually.
Hopefully.
I hate doing an interview, Joe. You know, I've done a lot of interviews, and I've actually said it to a lot of kids who'll be coming out of college, you know, and do you have a list of questions, you know? I fucking hate interviews like that. You don't get that done, you know? You're better just talking like that, you know?
Yeah. And so how are you doing now,
The condition I have is called amyloidosis. I have two cancers. I have a thing called amyloidosis and multiple myeloma. Right, the amyloidosis is the most serious one. So basically how it works is everybody's marrow produces these proteins called lambda and kappa proteins, right? So you and everybody produces one for one, so there's a ratio of one for one, right? So what I do is I produce two, I start, my kappa protein produces more negative proteins, right? And these proteins attack my organs, my kidneys and my heart and all that carry on. So when I got the amyloidosis, by the time they diagnosed it, my heart, I have a defibrillator here, you know, defibrillator for kicking your arm.
Yeah.
So I flatlined in hospital now because my heart is about two-thirds of its capacity now, you know, it's what it should be. So by the time they diagnosed it and stopped, the chemo stopped the production of this thing. So when I did the chemo 4 years ago, so the chemo kind of stopped the production of the amyloid or the cancer. And for 4 years on average, it stops it. So I'd have to go to London because they have a scan over there called a SAP scan. They don't have one here that detects it. So I was over there in January, the beginning of this month, and they seen it was reproducing again. So I'm back on chemotherapy. So I started chemotherapy a couple of weeks ago because cancer's producing again. So because it stopped it the first time doesn't mean it's going to stop it this time. You don't know. Every time's a roll of the dice. So I'm just hoping at the moment, you know. But I'm really sick at the moment, like at the end of my stomach, and you're seeing me there in and out of
PMJX.
I'm on fluid because it affects your kidneys and stuff. You're not getting rid of fluids. So you have to take tablets to make it get rid of fluids. So it's a fucking nightmare, you know.
Yeah. I was actually talking to Andrew Casty down in Boyles and Slane there, and he was saying that his father...
That's right, I met his father just before he died.
And he said that you had to carry him down the stairs.
That's right, for the gig, yeah.
I don't know if did you say what has he got or something, what's wrong with him, because...
No, I don't know. I knew he was sick. I knew he had cancer and all that. That was very sad.
Yeah.
He was very ill, you know, and it was just before he died. And what happened was he'd wanted to run a festival in Slane a couple of years before that, the one that I met you at. It never materialized, but he wanted us to play at it, you know, to headline it, but it never materialized. So he asked us, would we play? It was just before he died. Andrew asked us, would we do a gig in Boyles?
Yeah.
So the only way we could make it feasible was to do two gigs because it cost us too much to go up and do one gig. So we did two nights there, and it was particularly, I might as well just be in for the father. And they were great gigs and that, you know, but we did it specifically for the father. And then I think the reason that gig happened last year was Andrew probably still had it in his, you know, that his dad always wanted to do this.
Yeah, right.
I'm just surmising here. Yeah. But that's the, that's the story. But no, maybe one of the others said something like that. I don't know. But I knew what the whole deal was. So.
Right. Anyway, yeah, thanks for having the chat. I was just talking, I believe you were in the Luke Kelly
tribute. Great, yeah.
Yeah.
Enjoyed that.
I believe you sang at a higher
octave. Who told you that?
Vinny told me.
Oh, man, do you know what happened was, right, I sing Greenfield of France in A, right, and I sing Crazy World in D, right? Mm. So I had no guitar, I had no musicians with me, I just went in. Yeah. And I met a banjo player for the first time, an Illinois player, John Sheehan from the Dubliners, the violin player, and a guitarist. So I said, right, I do that and C. So we went through a verse of each in the dressing room, like 5 minutes before the gig, right? Yeah. So I said, when we go out, you just hit the first chord and I'm off. That'll get me the note and I'm head off, right? Mm. So we just, boom. So instead of it starting, when I was a young lad, you hit the chord. When I was a young lad, I carried me pack. So by the time it went, what's the chorus of it? And the band played Waltzing Matilda.
You were up there.
So I says to her on the way home, I said, the last time the chemo affected me voice really badly, I said, the fucking chemo's already hit me voice. I says, I was bleeding, struggling with that song. I said, that's an easy song. Normally I wouldn't have a problem with it. I says, I was fucking struggling there and I was depressed as fuck all day Sunday here. I was fucking God. Honest to God, I was in the height of it. So I'm here on Sunday night and Chris Kavanagh, the guy who does the Luke Kelly, who banjo player on the night, says to me, you know, he says, he rang me and he says, Jesus, John Sheehan come over to me. He says, that fucker's not human, you know. And I says, why? He says, we hit the first chord of Crazy World, which is a D, and you start singing fucking Greenfields of France. So that's a half an octave up.
He
says, how the fuck is he hitting those notes? And I says, you're bleeding kidding me. I says, I'm at the been slitting me fucking wrists here all day today, thinking my voice was gone because I couldn't get the notes as comfortably as I'd normally get them, you know.
That's so unbelievable.
I was fucking thrilled because I really thought, my voice is fucked. That's it, I'm fucked.
Yeah.
Because I don't know, as a singer, right, every morning you wake up, and I kind of do a few little, sing something just to see if your voice still there. It's probably like you as a comedian. Do you know what I mean? You're always trying to keep on top of your game.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So the thoughts of my voice being gone, it fucking crucified me. Like all the addictions thing and all. If I hadn't had this, I'd have never got out of that. Like no matter how much fucking work I'd have done on myself, if I hadn't had music and me singing and that, I couldn't have done it. That's what helped. That was a huge, you know.
I hope it's recorded. I think it is, actually.
It is recorded. I tell you, I wouldn't listen to it because it's fucking terrible. You know, it's because, you know, I wasn't comfortable singing, kind of, I'm struggling through it, you know.
It sounded good.
Listen to it. You might find it on YouTube or something.
I'm going to ask you, Christy, I don't know if you can do this if you want, but with any chance you could sing a song or something like that?
What would you like me to sing?
Obviously a cappella, but...
I'll sing a verse to the Greenfields of France.
Class.
Right, hold on, I got some water. Right, this is a song I've only sang it a couple of times. It's written by the same bloke who wrote the Greenfields of France, a guy called Eric Bogle. He's a Scottish immigrant, lives in Australia, and he was a real anti-war kind of dude. He's still alive. But he wrote this song, and he wrote Greenfields of France. I'll just sing a verse of it, right?
Thanks.
When I was a young lad, I carried me pack, and I lived a fair life of a rover. From Murray's Green Basin to the dirty outback, I waltzed my Matilda all over. Then in 1916, my country said, son, it's time to stop your rambling, there's work to be done. So they gave me a tin hat and they gave me a gun, and they sent me away to the war. And the band played started waltzing Matilda as the ship pulled away from the quay. But amid all the cheers, flag waving and tears, we were sailed off to Gallipoli. 'Tis well I remember that terrible day when our blood stained the sand and the water. And in that hellhole they call Suvla Bay, we were butchered like lambs to the slaughter. Then a big Turkish shell blew me arse overhead, and when I awoke in my hospital bed and I saw what it done, oh, I wished I was dead. Never knew there were worse things than dying. So no more I'll go waltzing Matilda across the green bush far and near, for to hump tent and pegs a man needs both legs. No more waltzing Matilda for me, waltzing Matilda, waltzing Matilda, who'll come a waltzing Matilda with me? And their ghosts can be heard as they march past the billabong. Who'll come a waltzing Matilda with me?
Well, that was great, wasn't it? I mean, what a man. Christy was just brilliant, and his voice is amazing. I would love to talk to him again sometime. So, yeah. So anyway, but look, if it's your first time listening to the podcast, do have a listen into the archive there. There's lots of great ones. We mentioned Willie White at the beginning, but there's also a great one with Anne Gildee, I would say. I really like that. I'm going to mention ones that aren't the famous people that everybody goes to listen to. There's also Jason Byrne that's live at the Stag's Head. He's one of the more famous people, but it's... I put the title on wrong there. I just said live at the Stag's Head, but it's Jason Byrne. And so if you could check that one out. I think it's the last live one we did at the Stag's Head. And there's Mundy. There's Simon Delaney. Fikra Trench, pretty good one. Oh, Christine Volset, more recently, the girl who spent time with the guys who ride horses around city centre in around Cork Street. Yeah, so there's lots of good ones there. And yeah, coming up, there's lots of good ones. And I'm on for my gigs, and for any contact you want to make with me, you can get me at www.joerooneycomedian.com or on my Twitter, JoeRooney1, and you can tell me. Give me your fucking reaction to the podcast on Twitter. Tweet if you like it. Tweet about it. Go on Facebook at Joe Rooney. See you next time, Mo. Yo. Yay, man. See ya.
This show is part of the Head Stuff Podcast Network, a hub for the creative and the curious. Shows are produced in association with Head Stuff and the Podcast Studios Dublin. Find out more or become a member at headstuffpodcasts.com.